from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, November 22nd, marks the 50th anniversary of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy's assassination. We talk to leading presidential historians and journalists about JFK's life and legacy. That's next. We invite you to join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. This Friday marks the 50-year anniversary of the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the 35th president of the United States, who was murdered in Dallas, Texas, while riding in a motorcade through Dallas's Dealey Plaza. President Kennedy was 46 years old, and in this Forum hour, we want to remember and assess the 1,000-day Kennedy presidency with a panel of leading presidential historians and one of the nation's leading journalists. Robert Dalek is joining us, presidential historian and author. His most recent book is Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House. And welcome, Robert Dalek. Good to have you back on Forum.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
We want to welcome also H.W. Brands, who is history professor at the University of Texas in Austin, author of over 20 books on history and politics, including most recently The Man Who Saved the Union, Ulysses S. Grant, and War and Peace. And welcome, H.W. Brands.
My pleasure.
We also want to welcome Joel Abramson, who is executive editor of the New York Times, author of a recent article which appeared in the New York Times Book Review on books that have been written about John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Joel Abramson, welcome to Forum. Good to have you.
Lovely to be with you.
I guess, if I may, I'd like to begin with you, Joel Abramson. I should mention to listeners you wrote the foreword of The Kennedy Years by Richard Reeves, and this article that appeared in the New York Times was really an assessment of all of the books that have been written, or some of the major books that have been written about Kennedy. All of them would amount to about 40,000. But that's just the point. There's been a kind of biomania, and I think that's what Larry Sabato called it, and more books being published now on the 50-year anniversary. And yet, as you point out, he still remains very elusive to us.
He sure does. Not only elusive, but in some ways misunderstood and interpreted in so many different ways. But my conclusion in the piece I wrote is there have been some excellent books written about President Kennedy, including a great biography that Mr. Dalek wrote. But I think a really great book that captures all the facets of this really fabulous, quintessential American life and making of a president and leader in the latter half of the 20th century remains to be written, that the great book is as elusive in some ways as the man himself.
As his life and his death remain elusive to us, a mystery, as you say, maybe even a void, I think is a word you use, an enigma.
I think that that's all true. He, in many ways, was our first high-wattage celebrity president, familiar to the country, especially through television, which was becoming the dominant way that all Americans absorbed their news, but still very much enigmatic.
Well, but a lot of, I suppose, what makes him memorable, and we'll talk about this with Robert Dalek in detail, but was the glamour, the charm, the myth, the celebrity status, as you put it, and maybe the fact that television played such an important role in this presidency of a man who was quite photogenic as well.
He and especially, you know, we haven't really talked about Jacqueline Kennedy yet, but, you know, in some ways, Jackie Kennedy turbocharged the celebrity of President Kennedy. They became the golden couple, the object of worldwide fascination, and, you know, the world really hadn't seen anything like it until then.
With
when you think about, you know, President Roosevelt was someone who captured the imagination of the world, but Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt were very different kinds of characters and not elusive in the least bit.
They also had adorable young children, we should mention, and so they were the first family. I think Von Meter's record was probably the most popular record of its time ever, historically.
I know. It just has been reissued. One of the other things for the 50th anniversary, the album has just been reissued after decades of being a little bit hard to get. In fact, Von Meter and his cast had just come out with a second album at the time of the assassination, and they bothered to go back and collect all the copies of it, and it was, you know, put in a warehouse somewhere and destroyed. So that iconic record is now available for everyone to listen to again 50 years later.
And again, Jill Abramson is executive editor of the New York Times and author of an article which appeared recently in the New York Times Book Review about books written about John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Some of those books have been written by Robert Dallek, who is a presidential historian and author, most recently Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House, which is really a close-up view of, well, what David Halberstam perhaps somewhat ironically called the best and the brightest, or Ted Sorensen called the Ministry of Talent. And I guess what set you off to write this most recent book, Robert Dallek, was just this 2010 Gallup poll that said of the last nine presidents, JFK was way out in the lead in terms of approval. Reagan, about 74%, but JFK, 85%.
Yeah, it really puzzled me somewhat because but, you know, what I thought of is the famous saying of the great Dutch historian Peter Gale, who said that history is argument without end. And, of course, this is particularly the case about the Kennedy assassination. We're probably going to be talking about this for forever. But there is always these uncertainties about what these presidents intended. But it's compounded in this case by the fact that Kennedy's presidency was unfinished. It was he had such a brief time in office, but he did make such a impressive mark on people's imaginations that they can write anything on the slate they want, and so he becomes a kind of focus for people who want to think of a better America, or that so many of the things that happened after he died, the Vietnam War and Watergate, the scandals, the failed presidencies of Ford and Carter, of the second Bush, one might say, and they can imagine a better America if only Kennedy had not been killed.
There's a lot of imagining, too, though, about the time that he did serve as president, his tenure as president, about 1,000 days. And I know, for example, there are books now that are saying, well, Kennedy was really a conservative. It was mainly people like Sorensen and Schlesinger who gave him the progressive identity that he seems to have in many people's minds. He was strongly a Cold Warrior. He was strongly in favor of the free market. He was wanted tax cuts, all of those kinds of things, which seem to suggest that maybe it was a different Kennedy than the Kennedy in many people's minds.
Well, the problem, I guess, is that he was all those things. He was a Cold Warrior, and he was also someone who was reaching for long-term peace. What I found in this most recent book is that he was deeply, deeply concerned about these nuclear weapons, and he battled mightily with the Joint Chiefs of Staff over the issue of whether one should even think about using them. And during, of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis, they pressed him very hard to bomb and then invade Cuba. He didn't want to do it. He was afraid it could touch off a nuclear war. And he was quite right, because we know retrospectively now from Soviet documents how close we came to a nuclear conflict. But they were, at the end of the missile crisis, they said to him, "Mr. President, you've been had. Khrushchev is hiding those missiles in caves." And they wanted to lay a plan to invade in case this were true. So Kennedy said, "Well, contingency plans are something that are always made. Go ahead." But part of their plan was to drop a 1 megaton nuclear bomb on Cuba. And he thought this was just almost crazy and bizarre to think that you would turn that island into a pile of rubble, let alone what you would do to the south coast of Florida by dropping a nuclear bomb on Cuba.
Well, this speaks, this is part of really what speaks loudly in your book and prominently about Kennedy's legacy. That is, not only was there a nuclear test ban treaty that may have saved us from nuclear war, but I think you make the point pretty strongly that the Bay of Pigs convinced him not to listen to his advisors, and then De Gaulle convinced him, of the same. In other words, this was real leadership. He had all these brilliant people around him, but he decided to do what he felt was right.
Yeah, De Gaulle told him, get the best possible counsel you can, the smartest people you can find, but at the end of the day, you have to make up your own mind. And Kennedy remembered what Harry Truman said, the buck stops here. And so I think that was his greatest virtue. But he learned. He became a better president as he went along. And so this also fuels the speculation as to what he might have done in the second term.
He went against some pretty militant Joint Chiefs of Staff and advisors.
He did. But, you know, I think one also has to try to understand why these Joint Chiefs were as militant as they were. And they had all come out of the Second World War. And their attitude was, when you deal with someone like Hitler or the Japanese military or the Soviets and Stalin in particular, although Stalin, of course, was dead for a decade by the time Kennedy was there, or when Kennedy was killed. And their attitude was, look, if they have these nuclear weapons, which they do, they would use them on us. And so we must not be so restrained. We have to think about beating them to the punch. But Kennedy, he simply didn't want to be remembered as the president who had fought a nuclear war, because he saw it as the doctrine of the time was called MAD, mutually assured destruction.
Robert Dallek, again, is presidential historian and author, most recently, of Camelot's Court Inside the Kennedy White House. And as far as Kennedy's legacy, I'm curious to know, as a historian, for example, H.W. Brands, what you make out of the more gossipy sides of Kennedy's presidency, 18-month-long affair with an 18-year-old intern and all the dalliances and so forth that were before Gary Hart's monkey business and therefore have not come to light. It cast a shadow over his presidency.
Has a certain romantic appeal, and I'll use that in both meanings of the term. It's sort of like having a crazy uncle or a crazy ancestor who's far enough into the past that he doesn't embarrass us anymore. I think the kind of people who are charmed by Kennedy are in some ways sort of charmed by the roguish aspect of it as well. There was quite reckless behavior, but we know that the recklessness didn't lead to any disaster because Kennedy is safely dead. I mean, I think that Bob Dallek is absolutely right when he calls his book An Unfinished Life, and I think the reason that we can make so much out of Kennedy is precisely because we get to write the last half of his life. If he had lived, that we wouldn't have that scope. You know, nobody remembers, there was no commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the death of Harry Truman, for example, because, you know, we sort of know how his life played out. And with Kennedy, Kennedy is essentially the first president that the baby boom generation remembered. And therefore, it's sort of like he holds the position in memory that Franklin Roosevelt did for the people who grew up during the Depression. You know, they thought this is the only president, and this is the president of, and I'm part of this generation, this is the president of our youth. And we think back on our youth as a time when things were simpler, and all the stuff that needed to be done was taken care of for us. And so we could imagine that if Kennedy had lived, that golden age would have persisted. But of course, it wouldn't have, it couldn't have. Nonetheless, the fact that Kennedy died handsome, died young, allows us to imagine the bad things that happened in the 1960s after Kennedy died wouldn't have happened. They would have, if he had been at the helm, things would have turned out better.
Well, that's part of the mystique, and in fact, it makes many people say that we wouldn't have gone into Vietnam in the way that Johnson went into Vietnam, and the civil rights legislation would have made it through, despite the fact that Johnson probably was the real architect, and his being a Southerner that allowed that legislation to get through. But apropos of something else, in terms of what you're talking about, the mystique that's lasted a half century, The Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis were really foreign policy errors, but they improved his image, didn't they?
There's this ironic aspect. When something bad happens to the United States generated from overseas, there's a rally around the flag effect. And you saw it, for example, with 9/11, when the popular approval rating of George W. Bush skyrocketed. And one could argue, why? I mean, this was an intelligence debacle, and 3,000 Americans are dead. But there is this feeling that we have no one else to rally around, so we rally around the president.
And that kind of rallying, even a half century later, continues where John Fitzgerald Kennedy is concerned?
Well, Kennedy is sort of safely dead, and therefore we can project on him anything that we want. And one of the things that liberals often forget, when they think that, I mean, you suggested that it was kind of an odd juxtaposition of Kennedy as the Cold Warrior, but he's remembered by the liberals. It's important to remember that the Cold War was originally a liberal project. Conservatives in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War said, no, we don't want to engage in these guarantees to Europe and other countries. We want to go back to sort of a smaller version of America, because if we get involved in the Cold War, then the government at home will grow, and we don't like that. It was liberals who, as much as anybody else, were behind the project of projecting American power overseas. And Kennedy fits squarely in that. Now, liberals developed a case of amnesia after that approach to the world went wrong in Vietnam. And they began to think, no, it was those bad conservatives who took us into Vietnam. No, in fact, Kennedy was smack in the middle of that liberal Cold War consensus.
But there are those who say he wouldn't have expanded the ground forces like Johnson did. In fact, one of them is Jeff Greenfield, who has a book now called An Alternate History of John F. Kennedy.
Well, it's certainly, that's one of those things you cannot disprove, and if you want to take that position, nobody can show that you were wrong. However, the Vietnam was not Lyndon Johnson's idea. It was the idea of all the presidents before him. It was squarely in the tradition that was established by Harry Truman with the Truman Doctrine, saying that the United States is going to go to the aid of beleaguered countries and the beleaguered governments beset by insurgencies and communist forces. And Kennedy would have had an extremely difficult time avoiding the pressure. He knew perfectly well that Democrats labor under the disability of having been perceived as soft on communism. And Kennedy would have had a great difficulty doing something that would have led to the fall of South Vietnam during his presidency.
Again, H.W. Brandt's history professor, University of Texas, and author of 20 books on history and politics, presidential historian, his most recent book, The Man Who Saved the Union, Ulysses Grant in War and Peace. And let me go back to Jill Abramson, who's executive editor of The New York Times, who did an article on many of these books that have come out recently on President Kennedy and that have been a part of, well, I guess call it the Kennedy canon. There are, as you point out in the article, Jill Abramson, a lot of flame keepers. I think you call them history police, but that's loosened up somewhat. It hurt loosen up with the papers, the Patriarch Papers and Caroline Kennedy, Patriarch Papers over Joe
right.
Kennedy. So are we perhaps going to see new lenses in all of this with maybe opening up generally?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, there are the group of people that I call the history police. Gary Wills, actually, the historian, had, I think, a better phrase for them. He called them the honorary Kennedys. They were people who were determined after the president's death to promote the myth of Camelot and to, you know, see his presidency and his life through a pretty gauzy filter. And they were overtly hostile to other writers and historians who took a different view and sometimes would publicly criticize them, would keep them from being invited to historical meetings of the American Historical Association and to debunk their books when they were published. I think it's true, Michael, that has somewhat loosened in recent years, and that the Kennedy family itself has been more inviting of, maybe not more inviting, but less determined to quash independent reporting and historical analysis of President Kennedy's time in office. Caroline Kennedy in particular, I applaud her for publishing a series of interviews that Arthur Schlesinger, who was definitely one of the honorary Kennedys, but Arthur Schlesinger, shortly after the president's death, did sit-down interviews with Mrs. Kennedy and asked her to reminisce about every aspect of her White House years. And the tapes of those interviews had been taken out of historical view and weren't available for historians to examine. And Caroline collaborated with others and brought out a book that included not only the text of the interviews, but fascinating CDs where, you know, you hear Jackie Kennedy's voice and the way she describes events. It's very, very interesting and compelling material. And then she also published President Kennedy. You know, everyone thinks of President Nixon as being the taper in chief, the president who installed a taping device in the White House and taped conversations. But actually, President Kennedy installed a taping system that he controlled. So whether it was on or off, rested in his hands. But he taped quite a lot, and those tapes also had been secreted away for decades. And Caroline, in recent years, published a book including those tapes, which include cabinet meetings and all kinds of historically meaningful incidents, as well as just revealing moments such as President Kennedy loses his temper with his staff because the press finds out that $5,000 in government funds was spent to outfit Mrs. Kennedy's hospital room when she was giving birth to one of her babies. And he was irritated that the public would know that such a profligate amount of money, $5,000 then, had been spent on this. So it's just very interesting glimpses. And Teddy Kennedy, before he died, had decided to open up some of his father's papers that had also never been shared publicly for the author of the very good biography and book about the Kennedy family, The Patriarch. So what had been very tight chains placed around all of this material, they've been loosened a little bit, not completely. There are things in the Kennedy Library and in the National Archives that are still closed to historians, and maybe in the ensuing decades we'll see the stricture loosened on that material also. I hope so.
I hope so, too. And if you've just joined us, we're remembering the Kennedy presidency, 1,000-day presidency, assessing the presidency, and you may indeed have memories of President Kennedy. I know certainly everybody who was old enough remembers the day he was assassinated, but call us and let us know what your thoughts are. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Any questions or comments you have are welcome. Again, the toll-free number, as we remember John Fitzgerald Kennedy coming up on his 50th anniversary of his assassination. You can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. Robert Dalek with us, H.W. Brands, Jill Abramson, and you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Crest. This is the Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about John Fitzgerald Kennedy and his presidency and the legacy of that presidency, since November 22nd marks the 50th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. We're talking with Jill Abramson, executive editor of The New York Times, and H.W. Brands, history professor at the University of Texas, whose most recent book is The Man Who Saved the Union, Ulysses Grant in War and Peace, and Robert Dalek, who is presidential historian and author of such books as An Unfinished Life and most recently Camelot's Court Inside the Kennedy White House. I should mention that Robert Dalek won the Bancroft Prize in 1979 for his book on FDR and American foreign policy, and has written about many presidents, as has H.W. Brands. Actually, Robert Dallek, I guess when we talk about the presidency of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, a lot of people, first of all, we know more, a lot more now about how he was suffering from Addison's disease and the kind of pain he was in. But in fact, he was given last rites, I think, four times. But you talk about his saving us from nuclear war. Actually, he resisted these hawks wanting war six times, that, at least according to your data, right?
Yeah, I mean, he was locked in struggle with them constantly. At the beginning of his presidency, McGeorge Bundy, who was the National Security Advisor, told him that local commanders could possibly touch off a nuclear war if there were an incident with the with Soviet forces, and you've got to rein these men in. You can't leave them this possibility to fight a nuclear war without your permission. Anyway, Bundy called up the general at the Pentagon who was in charge of the nuclear war plan. He said, we want to see this. And the general said, I'm sorry, we don't show it. And Bundy said, well, I'm afraid you don't understand. I'm calling for the president. Anyway, they then gave Kennedy a briefing, the Joint Chiefs, on what the nuclear war plan was. They described how they might use 170 atomic and nuclear bombs on Moscow alone, and they would kill hundreds of millions of Russians, East Europeans, Chinese in case of a nuclear war. And Kennedy was so chagrined when he walked out of the room, he turned to Dean Rusk, his Secretary of State, and said, and we call ourselves the human race. And he was just horrified by this. But, you know, I'd like to go back to a point that Jill Abramson was making, because she's quite right that there's been such a kind of a tight hold on Kennedy materials, and it's loosened up somewhat lately. And I was the recipient of that reduced control, because when I worked on my volume, The Unfinished Life, I asked permission to see the medical records. And they had been locked up in the Kennedy Library for 40 years, and there was a three-man committee controlling them, one professor at of the law school at Yale, another professor at Harvard, and then also Ted Sorensen. Well, the two faculty members signed off, but Sorensen didn't want to do it. I went to see him and talked him into letting me see the records. And then it was such an interesting mixed experience, because Arthur Schlesinger and Ted Kennedy, told me he didn't know about the extent of his brother's illnesses. That's how closely guarded this secret of his health difficulties were, until Ted said, until he read my book. And yet he and Schlesinger were full of praise, because they thought the revelations made Kennedy looked like looked very strong and courageous, stoic in the face of all these medical problems he had. But Sorensen was furious at me. And every time I'd see him, which wasn't often, but occasionally I'd see him, and he'd say, there was no cover-up. There was no cover-up. Well, I never argued with him, because I wasn't going to, you know, convince him. But he was such a keeper of the flame. And there is still some of that, of course.
What Jill Abramson says about what William Manchester had to go through. I mean,
well, exactly.
You know, it's very telling. Actually, I've got a caller here who's on point. I want to bring her on. Joan, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I remember in the 1990s hearing a news broadcast that President Clinton had reclassified a number of documents regarding Kennedy and probably also his death for 75 more years from the 1990s, after already being classified since the 1960s. And I wanted to know if you had any idea or had heard of this and knew what those documents might pertain to. Were they an assassination, or were they other things about his private life?
Robert Dallek?
Well, you know, we don't know what's in that material. And it's the same with 55 boxes of Robert Kennedy materials that are still closed and at the Kennedy Library. So who knows when we're going to find out? I mean, another 75 years, it's a bit frustrating and even painful to think that this material is locked up. But, you know, when it comes to Kennedy, I think the approach is that his reputation now has nowhere to go but down. The contrast with Lyndon Johnson I find very interesting, and I'm sure Bill Branston speaks to this too, that the Johnson Library is very eager to open materials as fully as possible, because in a sense Johnson's reputation is nowhere to go but up. And so I have seen this distinct difference between the two libraries.
Well, speaking of reputations, and let me thank the caller. I'll go to more of your calls in a moment, but I want to go to some of the emails here because and get you to opine on some of the opinions that are coming through here, H.W. Brands, from listeners, which essentially are, shall we say, deconstructing or trying to deconstruct some of the Kennedy myth. Listener named Dave writes, getting shot has been a powerful boost to the reputation of this otherwise mediocre leader. It has allowed our collective memory to forget such things as his craven retreat from civil rights legislation, his aggressive Cold War bumbling, including pushing us to the brink of nuclear war, among many other failures, and his very thin record is often ignored, while his looks and media image, greatly at odds with the reality of his personal life, take center stage. I say these things as someone who would probably have voted for him had I been of voting age. But his record is nothing to lionize. And here, just let me read a few more of these. Bob says, I too am puzzled by the near worship given to this three-year president. He didn't have time to leave much of any substance behind except the Man to the Moon project, and even that fizzled after it was achieved. I can only conclude that America, like other societies, places great value on charisma, looks, and celebrity, and little on genuine merit. And Cullen, another listener, writes, as president, JFK greenlighted the assassinations of two world leaders, Operation Mongoose, the unsuccessful covert operation supervised by his own brother, Robert Kennedy, to kill Fidel Castro, as well as the successful coup against the South Vietnamese president, Ngo Dinh Diem, that has resulted in the killing of Diem and his brother. Granted, it was shocking that a young, charismatic American president had been killed, but 50 years later, shouldn't we have some perspective on the events of that time, especially given JFK's willingness to use covert operations and assassinations as a foreign policy tool? Professor Brands.
Yeah. Well, the comments reflect a disjunct that's long existed between popular perceptions of Kennedy and I'll call them professional perceptions of Kennedy. When historians in political science have been asked to rank Kennedy as a president, he's been, generally speaking, somewhere in the middle of the pack. But as you suggested very early in the show, when the general public is asked, he's considered to be one of the great presidents. And historians kind of have scratched our heads at this. I guess it's a reminder that we should be humble that we're not getting the message across. But there's something that's quite different that's going on here. And one, I think it reflects the fact that the president of the United States is at once head of government, to the extent that we have a head of government, and head of state. And as head of government, he had to deal with all the difficult issues that heads of government do. And he did okay. I wouldn't be quite as critical as the first email that you quoted, but I would say that his record of accomplishment was indeed rather thin. But as head of state, he appealed to Americans' notion of what they wanted their country to look like. He was this refreshing contrast to Dwight Eisenhower, who seemed of an earlier generation, who seemed old and tired. There's a great irony here that even when he left the White House, Eisenhower was probably healthier than Kennedy was, who was a generation younger. But nonetheless, there was this impression, and impressions count, especially as the first president really of the television age. He understood how to use television as a medium. What Theodore Roosevelt was to the mass circulation newspapers and Franklin Roosevelt was to radio, JFK was to television. And that counts, especially in the popular perceptions of a president.
Let me bring more callers on. Rob, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. For the historians, you know, after the Bay of Pigs fiasco, President Kennedy famously said that he wanted to shatter the CIA into a thousand pieces and scatter it to the winds, and then reported it recently as that he wanted to set up his own intelligence agency with him at the top of it. Is that true? Did he take other concrete steps to make any of that true? Could that have led to his death? And also, you know, well, the last thing, what was I going to say on that? He fired, or he resigned. Forced into resignation, Alan Dulles of the CIA, who then served on the Warren Commission, and also Richard Bissell, head of covert operations. So was his assassination one of these types of Arbenz or Mossadegh assassinations?
All due respect, Rob, I think we're in speculative territory here, to put it mildly, although there's a new book out on the Dulles brothers that's certainly pretty illuminating. But what about his relationship with the CIA, Robert Dulles? I mean, he did fire Alan Dulles.
He did, without question. But, you know, he was very cautious because, remember, he won that election in 1960 by 118,000 votes. He brought Republicans into his administration. He kept J. Edgar Hoover on. He kept Alan Dulles on. And he replaced Alan Dulles with John McCone, who was a very conservative CIA director. And so while he was angry at them and was very reluctant to follow their advice, he wasn't going to shatter them into a thousand pieces. I don't doubt for a minute that he said that. In fact, I'm sure he said it, but he wasn't going to tear them apart. It was politically too dangerous for him.
And if I can go back to you, H.W. Brands, a Facebook comment from a listener of ours named Robert says, again, this may be speculative, but I think it's a point worth, it's a salient point, one worth considering. He writes, how much has the public imagining of JFK been affected by the public lives and deaths of his brothers, his wife and son? Bobby and Teddy in particular became liberal icons. And did their political evolutions cast President Kennedy in a more liberal light in public consciousness?
I think that's a very good point. And it allows the possibility that Kennedy's views themselves would have evolved. And as Robert Dalek suggested, he was learning on the job. Presidents do. What he would have become, we don't know. But for those people, especially liberals, who want to find a liberal president they can cheer about, Kennedy gives them this kind of blank slate to write on. There is no way of saying that wouldn't have happened. You certainly can't say positively that it would have. John Kennedy was, I mean, this is going to sound contradictory, but John Kennedy was as conservative in foreign policy as Cold War liberals were. Would he have changed his mind? I think it would have required something to change his mind, and that might have been, well, defeat in Vietnam, perhaps.
And Jill Abramson, another thing that I found fascinating in the piece you did in the New York Times Sunday book review section was, of all those books and of all those things that have been written and continue to be written about Kennedy, maybe our old friend Norman Mailer got it right early on when he did that article for Esquire, Superman Comes to the Supermarket.
He definitely got it right. Was really his first significant piece of political writing. And Mailer had gone out to Los Angeles to write about the Democratic Convention there and was just captivated by JFK. And, you know, he really observed him somewhat from a distance, went to his press conferences, watched as his motorcade arrived at his hotel at L.A., and seemed to have completely understood his appeal and his personality as well. And I think the other writer who just really beautifully captured, especially the president's death, is just, you mentioned before, William Manchester. And anyone who finds themselves fascinated on this 50th anniversary with the assassination and with the very sad denouement of the Kennedy presidency could really do no better than to get a copy of Death of a President. It's beautifully written. The amount of reported detail in it is just absolutely astonishing, whether Manchester is reporting on the scene in on Air Force One after the assassination, when LBJ is waiting to be sworn into office, to, you know, numerous other scenes. Jackie Kennedy had invited Manchester just, you know, a month after her husband's death to become the authorized writer, the only writer that Kennedy's family and his closest associates would cooperate with. And Manchester had complete access to just about everyone. The only person who he never got to interview was Marina Oswald. But it's really an incredible book and a great read. And what is ironic is that there was this colossal falling out between Manchester and Jackie and Robert Kennedy, who handpicked him to write this book. And then they became enraged that Manchester got a healthy amount of money for a magazine serialization of the book in Look magazine, and the relationship fell apart from there. And, you know, they went to court to try to prevent the book from being published. It eventually was published and kind of faded from public view. And Little Brown has just reissued it. And it really, I thought it was a magnetic book. You sort of pick it up and you can't put it down.
Again, we welcome your involvement in the time left in the program. If you have memories of the Kennedy administration or really have some thoughts about assessing the 1,000-day presidency of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum at kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. And I thought we'd hear a clip from a speech entitled A Strategy of Peace, a commencement address delivered by President Kennedy at the American University in Washington, D.C. on June 10, 1963.
No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue. As Americans, we find communism profoundly repugnant as a negation of personal freedom and dignity. But we can still hail the Russian people for their many achievements in science and space, in economic and industrial growth, in culture, in acts of courage. Among the many traits the peoples of our two countries have in common, none is stronger than our mutual abhorrence of war.
Robert Dallek, I think you called that one of the better presidential speeches of the 20th century.
Yes, I did, and I would stand by that. I think Kennedy's request or advice to the American people that they should rethink the way in which we looked at the Soviet Union was really quite impressive. I think if he had lived, I think we might have seen detente during his second administration or second term sooner than we saw it with Richard Nixon. Because, you see, I think he was terribly sobered, and Khrushchev was too, by that missile crisis. They were frightened by how close they had come to a nuclear conflict. And so, as I said, I think he grew in office. He changed. We'll never know exactly what he would have done, of course, but this was a kind of landmark speech. On the other hand, one should also remember the speech he gave in Berlin, in which, you know, he said, "Ich bin ein Berliner," and he talked in these very critical ways about communism and the ugliness of that system, and it was very much that what Bill Brands calls that liberal Cold War rhetoric that was so so fierce and tough on the Soviets. So, you know, he was, and this gets back to Jill Abramson's point, he was many men in a sense. He was different people, and you can right onto that slate, almost anything you want.
He was, as I think Falstaff said about Prince Henry, a man of many colors. And I'm looking at I want to bring another cut out here, actually. This is President Kennedy from the Oval Office, June 11, 1963. And this is his proposal of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if, in short, he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place? Who among us would then be content with the counsels of patience and delay?
H.W. Brands, there's a mixed record in many people's minds on President Kennedy and civil rights, despite the kind of sympathetic words we just heard.
I think Kennedy's heart was in the right place on civil rights. I think he was not as well positioned by any means as Lyndon Johnson would have been. The civil rights revolution, the legislative revolution, civil rights, the 64 Civil Rights Act and the 65 Voting Rights Act, those were two of the great legislative accomplishments of the second half of the 20th century, and it required somebody who understood how to operate, how to work with Congress. Kennedy could propose that kind of thing, but I don't think he could deliver. Lyndon Johnson could deliver, and it took a lot of work from Johnson. In fact, work that included basically, as Johnson himself recognized, consigning the South to the Republican Party for a generation or more. I think that Kennedy wanted to do the right thing. I don't think he had it in him to deliver that right thing.
Let me bring another caller on, and that's you, Philip. Good morning.
Hi, great show. You know, there's two narratives that always take my attention with Kennedy with respect to the double cross. So most people don't remember that Kennedy barely won the election, and he won it in Chicago. And his father, Joe Kennedy, who had made his money rum-running and had a lot of, let's just say, mafia connections, delivered the election for him. And there were two outcomes from that I'd love to hear you talk about. The first is the betrayal that Nixon felt and just festered in him and probably had a lot to do with why Nixon, you know, cheated on the election and investigated and why he got impeached. And then Bill Clinton, the Republicans at the time, said that was payback for Nixon's being impeached. And the second part of the double cross in Chicago was the RICO Act. So here the mafia helps him, you know, deliver daily. And none of this is conjecture. This is fairly well understood history. But the part that's not known is then after they go and get him elected, he passes the RICO Act, you know, puts Bobby Kennedy in as attorney general, and then starts throwing the mafia in jail. And the Bay of Pigs had a mafia connection, too. And you know, some people think that had something to do with his death. So I'm curious to hear what your guests think about that.
Now, there's a lot in your call, if I may say so. Philip, Robert Dalek?
Well, you know, Kennedy, like Franklin Roosevelt, Herbert Hoover said of FDR, he was a chameleon on plaid, which I think is a wonderful way to describe these very effective politicians. And the election of 1960, I think what made the huge difference was having Lyndon Johnson on the ticket. Of course, Daley and the Democratic machine in Illinois was going to counter anything the Republicans were doing in downstate Illinois to stuff the ballot boxes there.
So, forgive me, Robert Dalek, but it was pretty clear that Kennedy would not have had Johnson on the ticket had he lived to run for another term.
Oh, I'm not so sure about that. Yeah. I think they were very worried about the possibility of Bobby and the president were worried they were going to lose the South because of Kennedy's civil rights speech and the proposal for civil rights legislation in June of 63. So I think there may have been compelling reasons for him to keep Johnson on the ticket in order to. And also, why did he go to Dallas? Because he was involved there with political fence mending in order to try and assure that the Democratic Party held on to the and he held on to the state of Texas in the 64 election. So I think it's you know, again, we'll never know exactly, but that would be my speculation.
I'm reading some listener comments about remembrances of President Kennedy. Peter writes, I was 15 when President Kennedy was killed. I mourned his passing more than I much later mourned the deaths of my parents. Watching films of Jack and Jacqueline Kennedy takes me back to those times, such class and elegance. And that said, I can intellectually acknowledge his many shortcomings, some of which were hidden long after his death, but he was an inspiration. And on an emotional level, no public figure before or since has had a comparable impact on me and many of my generation. And another listener, Lou, writes, during Kennedy's presidency, his speeches were published unedited in the New York Times, and as a graduate student, I studied them carefully. I still regard the test ban speech, I believe, of April 1963 as one of the best speeches in U.S. modern history, probably the high point of his otherwise rather mediocre presidency. And here's another, Philip from San Francisco. Hi.
I was 18 years old when John F. Kennedy came to Hebert Springs, Arkansas, and dedicate Greer's Ferry Dam. It was his last public address, and I managed to shake his hand, and I told him, I'm proud of your stand. 20 years later, Pierre Salinger came to USF, where I've taught for 35 years, and he met with faculty and staff before a public address entitled 20 Years After the Kennedy Legacy, and I asked him a question. I said, is there anything particular you remember? And he was perturbed because he had spent so many years with Kennedy, and he's also Pierre Salinger was also a USF graduate. And he said to me, one thing came to his mind. He said, one time we walked out of the meeting with the generals over the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he said, I wonder if those generals realize that if I make one mistake, it will be the death to 200 to 250 million people. And I'm wondering if Professor Dalek ever met with Pierre Salinger and discussed that particular, his remembrances of President Kennedy. And I am still impressed, fascinated, but it was a highlight of my life to shake his hand.
Robert Dalek.
Well, I never met with P.S. Salinger, but it certainly sounds like the kind of thing Kennedy would have said in response to this possibility of killing so many people with nuclear weapons.
Let me thank the caller and go right to another caller. Neil, join us. Hi.
Yes, I'm wondering if any of you have even heard of Ultimate Sacrifice and its sequel, Legacy of Secrecy, both by Lamar Waldron and Tom Hartman. The books are being boycotted by the press that won't even review them, but they seem to contain more and better information, critical information about Kennedy's assassination and about the aftermath of it than anything that's been published so far. Have you even heard of these books? Would you be willing to read them?
Do you know about them, Jill Abramson?
I don't know about them. I don't.
Neil, do you put much stock in them, or do they have any credibility?
I mean, it's not just that they are credible, but that the quality of the writing and research is so good that the books demand attention and respect, even if you don't agree with their conclusions. Their conclusions are that Kennedy's assassination was a mob hit, and that the reverberations of this caused a lot of intelligence problems and Cold War problems right after that.
Well, the assassination itself is a whole other topic and perhaps for another day, but in the meantime, we've come to the end of this hour, and I want to extend thanks to all of the distinguished panel for joining us. Jill Abramson, again, is executive editor of the New York Times, and her article on many books on Kennedy appeared in a recent article in the Sunday New York Times Book Review. Thank you for being with us, Jill Abramson.
Thanks so much, Michael.
And thanks to you, H.W. Brands, history professor, his newest book, The Man Who Saved the Union, Ulysses Grant in War and Peace, professor of history at the University of Texas, Austin. And thanks, Professor Brands, for being on this program.
I was glad to join you.
And thanks to Robert Dalek, presidential historian and author, most recently Camelot's Court Inside the Kennedy White House. Appreciate your being with us, Robert Dalek.
My pleasure.
And we thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Thank you for being a part of this program. For all of us here from KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.